listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Way We Made the Way We Were by Barbara Streisand. Sydney and I flew back together to New York to shoot it, and it was time well spent, because I managed to convince him to put back more of Arthur's words. The scene starts with a shot of the iconic Plaza Hotel. Then we see Katie walking toward it. She spots Hubble at the entrance. He spots her and does a double take. It's very hard to do a good double take, and Bob's was great. He smiles, she smiles, and crosses the street to talk to him. Music is playing beneath all this. They hug and kiss in a long shot. He's with another woman, and introductions are made. We can't hear the dialogue, but we can see how friendly they are through their body language. Now the camera is closer. He asks her if she's still married. So clearly she's moved on too, and Katie asks him what he's doing in New York. He tells her that he's been writing a television show. Then the doorman says his taxi's ready. Katie says she's late and invites him to come for a drink as she runs back across the street to pick up a stack of Ban the Bomb leaflets. She's back doing what she loves. Suddenly she hears Hubble, alone this time, saying, "You never give up, do you?" I love that echo from the scene in the projection room. "Only when I'm absolutely forced to," Katie responds. "But I'm a very good loser. Better than I am." Very good line. It says everything, without saying it. "Well, I've had more practice." Then she says, "Your girl is lovely, Hubble. Why don't you bring her for a drink when you come?" "I can't. I can't." Katie, sensitive as always, says, "I know." And that's when I reached out and brushed his hair off his forehead, and he clasped my hand as we come together in an embrace. We hold on to each other for that extra minute or two, remembering the way we were before we let each other go. I knew from the moment I first did that gesture in the nightclub that it would really resonate at the very end of the movie. And when I touch his hair, the music starts again, underscoring the emotion and reminding you of everything that has happened since they met. "How is she?" he asks. He hasn't seen their daughter since she was born. I always imagined Katie would send him pictures of her on her birthday. "She is just beautiful. You would be so proud of her, Hubble." "I'm glad. Is he a good father?" "Yes, very." "Good." He looks down and takes a leaflet. Then the music swells as they look at each other one last time. He says, "See you, Katie," and walks across the street and out of her life again. "See you, Hubble," she says softly. That's another poignant echo from their goodbye after that first night at her apartment. And then, as the film cuts to a long shot, leaving Katie standing on the street and handing out her leaflets, you hear my voice singing the song over the credits. By now, the audience is usually sobbing. But at the first screening, people didn't cry, and Marvin instantly knew why. He had scored the ending with a different melody, worried he might have overused the theme. "Big mistake," he said, and went into his own pocket to get the orchestra to re-record the ending with the familiar music. "And I can't imagine the movie without it." It's very gratifying to read that The Way We Were is now considered a classic. The American Film Institute named it number 6 on their list of the 100 greatest love stories, putting it right up there with Gone with the Wind and Casablanca. I, too, love The Way We Were and consider it a highlight of my career. I think it's one of Bob's best performances, and probably one of mine as well. and I'm thrilled whenever I see us listed as one of the screen's most romantic couples. We made something that will last a long time, much longer than most real marriages. Sydney did an excellent job and made a wonderful film. I know the picture works, but not as brilliantly as it could have, not with those essential scenes missing. Writing this book brought back all those memories, so in the spring of 2021, I asked Marty to call Tim Rothman, the head of Sony, which owns Columbia, to find out if they had anything planned for the 50th anniversary in 2023. When Marty told me they were going to reissue the original film on a new Blu-ray, I thought, oh my God, this may be my chance to finally restore those missing scenes, not only for me, but for Katie, and also for all the people who love this film. I had to persuade Tom to release an extended version as well. I truly believe that if Sidney were alive today, he'd agree to put those two scenes back into the movie, because they're about much more than politics. So I did something I've been aching to do since 1973. I still had all the trims saved, and I hired Mike Eric, the same editor who had worked with me on the first DVD, to sit beside me at my Avid editing machine and put them back into the film. I felt such a sense of purpose and responsibility, as if I were fulfilling a commitment to Arthur and to Hubble and Katie. I also wanted to retrieve some of her speech explaining why she had to go to Washington to support their friends, because it shows her political fearlessness. And it was important to me to put back that last, very revealing line at the end of the projection room scene when Katie says, "I want us to love each other." And Hubble responds, "We do. That's the trouble, Katie. We do." I realize now why Sidney had to cut that line. It contradicted his premise that their relationship was over. As he said in the documentary, this story reaches a point where you know these two people are finished, and it's at the end of the projection room scene. I didn't agree, and that's not what Arthur wrote. Katie loves Hubble and isn't the type to leave him over a one-night stand with an old girlfriend. And that line confirms that Hubble still loves Katie. I was there from Arthur's first script, and one of the reasons I like it is because it's so true. Love is complicated. I guess Sidney tried to simplify it because he couldn't have them both declaring their love at the moment they're supposedly finished. But we're rooting for this couple to stay together, and the only reason they don't is because Katie has been informed on, and she decides to end the relationship to protect him. This is what brings the audience to tears. Imagine how excruciating it is to love someone and be forced to deny yourself that love. There were other moments I would have included, like a scene where she's encouraging him to stay at the typewriter and keep writing. But I knew if I tried to restore too much, I risk losing the chance to restore anything at all. I could only add a few minutes, so I had to prioritize and focus on what was most important to the story. And the original footage fit right in because it was supposed to be there. It was Beshert, meant to be. A few weeks later, I rushed the re-edited version of the movie over to Tom Rothman because we had a phone appointment that day. He hadn't had a chance to watch it when we spoke, but his first reaction was not promising. He basically said, "You can't change the movie. It has to be the way Sidney left it." "I'm not trying to replace the original film," I told him. "It's a classic, and it will live forever. All I want is to give people the option of watching the extended version as well. Release both versions in one package." I explained that for years after the movie's release, Sidney was still not sure about those cuts, but Tom wanted to hear that in Sidney's own words, so I followed up that call with an 8-page letter, citing production memos where Sidney says the UCLA scene is very good. And the Frankie McVeigh scene was important because, as he wrote, We must see the price that both this relationship and life in general cost these two people. It was sad for me to see how Sidney continued to question his work on the movie. As he said in one interview, "I think it is a picture that is severely flawed, and it is saved really by the two performances. I think he's being too modest." As he said in another interview, "The pressure I was getting was just unbelievable. Truthfully, nobody had any faith in the picture. Now, having directed a few films myself, I completely understand that pressure. Also, The Blacklist went on into the early 60s, which was not that far away in 1973. Many people in Hollywood did not want to be reminded of their participation or offend the Republicans in power in Washington. Richard Nixon was president, and he had been very active in the HUAC. As Sidney said in another interview, there was resistance from the studio. As a result, we had to emasculate the picture. It did not successfully blend politics and love story to the extent it should have or could have." We sent Rothman the letter in mid-July, and then I waited and waited. As the summer wore on with no response, there was one person I really wanted to talk to, Robert Redford. I wanted to explain what I was doing and see how he felt about it. So I called him up, and Bob was wonderful, open and thoughtful and engaging as always. He said he would support me absolutely, which meant so much to me. We talked for over an hour about everything, from working together on the film to politics and art. When we were hanging up, he said, "I gotta go, Babs. I love you dearly, and I always will." I said, "I love you too," and invited him and his wife, Sybil, to come have dinner with Jim and me the next time they were in L.A. I told him, "I love talking to you," and he said, "I love talking to you. I always do." It was a sweet reminder that the connection we had during that movie still exists. Bob's vote of confidence made me even more determined to persuade Sony to let me put back those pivotal scenes. In August, I sent Tom an email, gently nudging him by mentioning more reasons to support my case. He replied that it was a complicated situation and would take more time to resolve because he and others were on vacation. Okay, but I sent another email to thank him for his reply and made another pitch. In other words, I was relentless. And thank God Tom finally relented. In mid-September, he called to tell me that the extended cut would be going into the new Blu-ray as well as the original. I was speechless for a moment. Hallelujah! I had been hoping for this since 1973. And then, in the midst of expressing my gratitude and telling him how much this means to me, I said, "Oh, one more thing. While we're at it, could you also do an iTunes release like we did for A Star Is Born, where both the original cut and my recut version with added scenes are available for the same price?" There was silence at his end, but I quickly went on to say, "Young people don't even buy Blu-rays anymore. They stream everything, and that's a whole new audience for the film." I was encouraged because he didn't say no right away, but as he reminded me, nor did I say yes. It wasn't until 4 months later that I was told he had approved the joint iTunes release. I can't tell you how happy I am that people are now going to be able to see this film the way it was originally conceived. It's only taken 50 years, but my dream has finally come true. As Hubble said to Katie, "You never give up, do you?" No, Katie never did, and neither do I. This article was adapted from the book My Name is Barbara by Barbara Streisand to be published November 7th, 2023 by Viking. Copyright 2023 by Barbara Streisand. The Rothschild Who Wasn't by Nate Freeman, with illustrations by Nicole Rifkin. Charming, enterprising, and fabulously wealthy, Kyle de Rothschild et Chanel was a New York sensation who lived on a 24/7 carousel of mega-dollar deals and raucous parties. Then his best friend found an ID labeled Arye Dodelson. Opening illustration shows a man's face, fractured, with the skyline of the city of New York in the background. There's a three-story, three-bedroom townhouse at 514 Broome Street in Manhattan, with an expansive ivy-laden terrace. Entry is through a dining room swathed in exposed brick. A stunning wooden staircase services the second floor. Venture to the basement, and you'll find a wine cellar big enough for 2,500 bottles. It's the only freestanding home in Soho, and it's available. Its owners, the personal injury attorney Seth Harris and his wife Bonnie, put it on the market in 2017, 2 years after buying it. Alyssa Brody, their broker, once hosted a churros and cocoa day to lure potential buyers. In February 2022, Brody went on NBC's Open House, hoping someone with deep enough pockets might be watching. "It's warm and cozy, with just the right touch of drama," Brody said, running her fingers over a wooden cabinet. Months later, a would-be buyer appeared out of nowhere, and Soho Central Casting, Kyle Deschanel, a nattily suited, funny, and charmingly stubbled man with piercing blue eyes, expressed interest in the home as a rent-to-buy proposition. At the time, Deschanel told people he worked for a discreet family office that had space on Wall Street and in Washington, D.C., and was in the process of closing a deal to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in Bijou's, a Bangalore-based education tech startup. During the early years of the coronavirus pandemic, when the global rich seemed somehow only to get richer, Oakshott Capital, where Deschanel said he was a managing director, had quickly burnished its reputation. According to an investment deck he circulated, Stampede, the film studio, founded by former Warner Brothers studio head Greg Silverman, tapped Oakshott to help raise $120 million. When Axiomatic, the gaming firm backed by Hollywood executive Peter Guber and Washington Wizards owner Ted Leonsis, was looking to raise funds and possibly spin off his esports platform, Team Liquid, Deschanel told others that it brought on Oakshott as the investment manager. Deschanel claimed to maintain lucrative business ties overseas, especially to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and its state oil company, Aramco. After months of moving between hotels and various leases in the West Village, Deschanel needed a real hub. Christina Cochran, a party planner at Van Wyck & Van Wyck, who told me she was Deschanel's best friend at the time, he and her other friends called her Teeny, had joined him house hunting. "I left work to come look at three apartments with him, and there were two just generally big white lofts in Soho. And then there was this townhouse," Teeny said. "I was obsessed with it." He was like, "I love those antique houses," and I was like, "This is it." Deschanel plunked down the cash for the $25,000 a month rental, telling Teeny there was a family trust. "He said he's in charge of it because he's the man of the family," Teeny recalled. "So he had to move around some money and then paid for it." Deschanel didn't otherwise talk about his trust, which could have been in character for a guy who grew up at 825th Avenue, as he told people he had. The address, a pre-war citadel of old money, still appeared on his driver's license. "If you're that rich," friends and acquaintances gathered, "you don't need to talk about money, or family, or homes. It's gauche." Occasionally, he'd break the wealth code, like when grief got to him. when billionaire socialite Lily Safra, who had lived in the building, died in June 2022. He texted Teeny. "She was my godmother. I was super close to her," he said. He was trying to get to Geneva for her funeral. "She was the most fab ever. Killed all her husbands," Deschanel went on. "Just true goals." And sometimes he'd show his cards as reassurance. On their first date, he offered a woman we'll call Donna a trip to Assateague Island in Virginia to see the wild ponies. "I was calling my mom, I was calling everyone, and I told him, 'I'm pretty sure this is how murder mysteries start, so I do not want to go on this trip with you,'" Donna said. He sent Donna a picture of his passport, which said that his real name was Paul Kyle de Rothschild de Chanel. When pressed, he would admit he was a Rothschild from a clan that centuries ago created modern banking and carries forth a name synonymous with outrageous wealth. He was like, "I don't think you realize who my family is." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" said Donna, who went on to live with Deschanel for nearly a year. "Don't worry," he told her. "Money is not an issue ever with me." In 2022, when Deschanel leased his Soho Dream mansion, he was nearly ubiquitous in downtown nightlife circles. Around this time, Emilio Vitolo was hosting parties at his family's restaurant on Houston Street, Emilio's Velato, where Rihanna has popped in for carryout, and Lenny Kravitz once bought a new awning in lieu of a tip. Vitolo turned the semi-private back room into a full-on club that served food and let patrons hang until the wee hours. Deschanel was there. He was one of Emilio's oldest friends, he told people. They grew up together. They went to Catholic school in the West Village. Another close pal was Adam Moonves, the son of former CBS czar Leslie Moonves, who's a part owner at the Chinatown hotspot Mr. Fong's. Deschanel was especially close with Dylan Hales, the Australian entrepreneur who ran the restaurant Little Ways and the bar The Flower Shop. Nightlife photographers caught Deschanel hobnobbing with the Australian model Bambi Northwood Blythe at the bar's anniversary party last March. Deschanel said he was on the board of trustees for SAMU, the brain health charity started by the Game of Thrones star Emilia Clarke and her mother, Jenny Clarke, my dear friends, as he put it in an email. He hosted events for the American Friends of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. At the Central Park Conservancy hat luncheon, he introduced himself to the late General Electric CEO Jack Welch's widow. He took dates to Marjorelle, the swank boite in the Upper East Side's Lowell Hotel. "Every time we went there, he knew every single person," said another former girlfriend we'll call Kara. "And a bill never came to the table there, just ever." Often his beneficiaries paid. Often his beneficiaries said he paid with his Oxshott Capital credit card. He clanged down the Golden Amex for hours of cocktails and caviar at the Nines or at Cipriani around the corner from the house. He would take dates to the major food group restaurants at the Seagram Building, the Grill, or the Lobster Club, where Wagyu runs $42 an ounce. He would always say, "It's so hard to date in New York, because all these girls are just after my money," said Tracy Sukat, an actor and model who knew Deschanel socially. He had a sort of unforgettable quality about him. He was worldly, well-connected, conversant in the dialect restricted to the old Europe families that drift through certain stretches of Italy and the south of France. But he was never boring or overly refined. "I'm hot and rich and nice and smart and have a killer dick," he once texted a friend. He told some friends he grew up in Manhattan, enrolled in Le Rosi in Switzerland, and did stints in schools in Japan and Sweden. He rode crew at Princeton, he said, but was anything but a staid prepster. He frequented the New Society for Wellness, a shame-free sex club in Soho. He had a self-aware streak, a rarity in such circles. Meeting Apollo's family office group, changing into dirtbag clothes, he texted a third woman he dated, we'll call Miranda. His attire for the supposed meeting with the private equity firm that has more than $500 billion in assets was a pair of tinted aviators and a flat-brimmed Modelo beer baseball cap. Sunglasses or no sunglasses, he asked. Which shows more, I don't give an F. His general demeanor was very much present on social media, primarily his extremely active Instagram handle at Degenerate Snoopy. It mostly consisted of memes built on old Peanuts cartoon capsules, with Coke jokes and an un-PC stuff written in the speech bubble. Bio, gentleman with edge, toxic, but like in a fun way. My preferred pronoun is daddy. Deschanel said he was on the road often, in Washington or Dubai or London, and frequently Riyadh. He told people that he worked for Aramco's parent entity, the Saudi Ministry of Energy, Industry, and Mineral Resources, and effectively was reporting directly to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. When new friends Googled Kyle Deschanel, an Aramco.com email address would pop up. He took late-night calls in Arabic. He'd casually mention his connections to certain global movers and shakers. On a group chat called Billion Dollar Blowies, he happily proffered a list of potential link-ups. A rising star trader, a couple of Blackstone hitters, the son of a well-known pro sports team owner. Daddy is a billionaire. He's annoying but eligible, Deschanel said. Eva Evans, a filmmaker based in New York and Los Angeles, dated Deschanel for a few months in 2022, after meeting him in the back room at Bilato's. He's very, very smart, and he's very funny, and he is very strange in somewhat of an entertaining way, Evans told me, almost an encyclopedic knowledge on a lot of different things. Evans remembered particularly his tossed-off asides, which often came out late. Occasionally, he'd even bring up his family. "Sorry, I'm three drinks in and on ketamine, but it's no excuse," he texted Evans. "If I ever say my family invented money again whilst funny, kill me." He wasn't conventionally handsome. He had a strange gait, a weird look, and could be insecure. Recipients thought he'd face-tuned photos of himself before sending, chiseling his jawline, sharpening his features. In person, he was pure charisma. I thought he was kind of ugly, and a little chubby, and just gross overall, and I was not interested, said one woman we'll call Genevieve. He was with this model who I recognized that is pretty famous, and yeah, then I kept running into him. He was very, very charming, so that's how we started hooking up. It helped that he had Broom Street. People were just constantly using him for afters, Miranda said. That was just where the party was always at. Bella Thorne, whom Deschanel claimed to have dated for a time, came by. His old friend Misha Barton was always around. There's a cute selfie of the pair in his Broom Street bathroom mirror. There was a top note of top models, Sophie Sumner, Teddy Quinlivan, Nina Agdal, Rachel Hilbert, Robert Pattinson, and Suki Waterhouse were at the New Year's Eve party at the end of 2022, where a chef dressed as a French maid and a seated dinner turned into an all-night rager. Pattinson couldn't immediately be reached for comment. Leonardo DiCaprio showed up to the house late one night with Richie Akiva. The nights were always late. He was, friends said, self-aware about that, too. That was the weird thing. I feel like drugs and being a degenerate, it was a big thing for him, Evans said. He would text you five different times, 3 a.m., 5 a.m., 8, being like, let's do drugs, let's do this, said a woman we'll call Ashley. He was just very pushy. Next illustration shows a building with a montage of drinking, money, romance, snorting coke, superimposed. Camille Orders, a model who runs a boutique events consultancy, recalled a lunch at Balthazar where Deschanel claimed he had just come from the headquarters of the United Nations, working as an envoy from Saudi Arabia. And then he immediately goes, "Do you want to do a bump?" Orders recalled. And I was like, "No, it's a Monday afternoon. It's like 2 p.m. I guess there are a lot of businessmen that do bumps during the day on a weekday, but somebody who works for the government probably would be regularly tested." Anyone seeking hard intel on Deschanel found the website of Oxshott Capital Partners. "We leverage deep global relationships, including in Asia and the Middle East, to source proprietary strategic and investment opportunities for our family office and select clients," it said, listing an address on K Street in Washington. According to records, Oxshott was legally incorporated in Delaware in 2018 by a Rockland County-based man named Yosef Meir Stern, who goes by Earn. He had previously worked for a Nanuet, New York pharmaceutical company called MedWiz Solutions and got his broker's license in 2019. Stern was a FINRA-registered broker-dealer, but struggled a bit in the first year to convert capital to deals, striking modest paydays, mostly when he was able to connect with startups abroad. In 2019, Deschanel reached out to Stern through a mutual friend, looking to put together some funds for an investment. The deal fell apart, but Stern saw potential. He gave off the impression that he was an ultra-wealthy individual with a deep Rolodex of influential people, and these were contacts that would only come from a person with status, Stern said in a statement provided by his spokesperson. A person who works in finance, whom we'll call Brian, who knew Deschanel socially, told me family offices, the kind of which Deschanel claimed to represent, are particularly alluring in fundraising. "That's the golden goose, because raising capital from an institution, you've got investment committees," he said. "If you're trying to raise money and you find out that there's a brand new family office with a couple of billion dollars that are just sitting there to be taken, you're taking him to dinners, you're taking him to shows, you're taking him to concerts, you're taking him to clubs, you're wooing him." Deschanel summed up his targets in an Instagram mention to Evans after casually mentioning that he was working on buying a piece of Twitter with Elon. He was texting in May 2022, weeks after Musk made public his desire to own Twitter, and perhaps that man's unbridled ambition was rubbing off on Deschanel. He described his mission at Oxshott thusly: late-stage venture and unicorns, essentially private companies worth over $1 billion. According to a 2023 SEC filing, Oxshott had $67 million in assets under management. By 2021, Deschanel was establishing a reputation as a dealmaker, at least in the very specific circles in which Wall Street and New York nightlife overlap. That December, he emailed a business acquaintance from his Oxshott account, asking him to take a look at a term sheet and an investor deck for Axiomatic, an esports venture that, among other investment opportunities, could leverage the perceived value of its gaming platform, Team Liquid. The spun-off Team Liquid could either be acquired or prepare an IPO in 18 to 24 months. The minimum buy-in was $2 million. The returns would be up to three times that. The investments would be deposited into a special-purpose vehicle incorporated by Oxshott, called RedShield Investment 11 LLC. Isaac Elshanan, the 16th-century Rothschild ancestor whose dwelling gave the clan its name, lived in a building in the Frankfurt Judengasse called Haus Zun Roten Shield, House of the Red Shield. A source sent me a screenshot of a text conversation between Deschanel and a potential investor in the deal, a person in banking who was dating a woman who ran membership at a very desirable private club. "Do you know anyone who'll lend me 10 to 40 MM bucks for 2 weeks? Need to find my deal, and our capital doesn't free up until January," Deschanel wrote. "I'll give you lots of monies." "Possibly, but what is my pitch?" the potential investor responded. "We're a family office, buying 10% of a company called Axiomatic. We already invested 30, and the company wants their remaining 40 this year. Our equity bucket is tapped for the year, so I need a bridge." Deschanel added after the pitch, "Who'd you sex last night?" Sometime later, Deschanel started shopping around an investor deck for a new entertainment company, Stampede Ventures. Founded in 2018 by Greg Silverman, the former Warner Brothers production head, Stampede wanted to handle independent productions and turn them into global hits. "Over the next 12 to 24 months, we are trying to make shows in 25 countries," Silverman told Variety in 2021. Deschanel started sending out a 47-page investor deck, indicating that Stampede had retained Oxshot, along with a media partner, to arrange $120 million worth of financing on behalf of the company. Plus, the deck said, Stampede already had movies in the pipeline, including an adaptation of the video game Dance Dance Revolution. Target leads, Channing Tatum and Zendaya. Tagline, the world is on the brink of destruction. Only by uniting in dance using Tatum and Zendaya can humanity be saved. A New York-based film producer I spoke to had met Deschanel a few years earlier when he was brought in as a potential partner in a major Los Angeles real estate deal. He came in and said, "I'm the Rothschild family owner buying this building," the producer recalled. The deal didn't go through, but they continued to run into each other at nightclubs or around Soho, often at the Israeli restaurant 19 Cleveland. The producer told me that when he needed a licensed broker-dealer partner for a potential deal earlier this year, he kicked Deschanel and Oxshot's tires. "They had real licenses. That checked out," he said. The great pitch was that this is a front for the Rothschild family office. He asked what else the company was offering, and Deschanel's colleague sent along a deal sheet that included two separate opportunities to buy into SpaceX, opportunities in the Palantir-associated defense product company Anduril, as well as a UK-based real estate technology startup called Caterio. The ask were aggressive. $50 to $60 million to get in on the HR systems unicorn Rippling, a $50 million direct transfer on TikTok developer ByteDance, an available $50 million buy on the Swedish fintech company Klarna, done through an Oxshot vehicle. Deschanel also began talks with a Toronto-based company that uses AI in the travel industry. According to a deck that was shared with Oxshot, projected revenue would skyrocket in the years to come, from $1 million in 2024 to $113 million in 2027. An executive at the company, whom we'll call Patrick, said that he initiated contact with Deschanel after another New York-based investor put them in touch with Oxshot. The startup sent Deschanel their deck, gave them access to the data room, and arranged the customary NDAs. Patrick was optimistic, especially after Deschanel told him more about his family. He booked a flight to New York to meet with Deschanel at La Durée. "Breakfast was like $300 or something insane," Patrick said. He recalled that Deschanel burst into negotiations like a hurricane. "He always acted like he was very important. He acted like the money was irrelevant. He acted like $5 million is nothing. His disposition was consistent with other billionaires that we've had as investors in our company, Patrick said. They like it or they don't. They're very binary. Ultimately, they couldn't come to terms. The startup was looking for $2 or $3 million, but Deschanel wanted to go in for more. They were looking to come in at a follow-on round for another $10 million in total, Patrick said. Kyle had said to me that round was too small for him. Patrick said he left the December meeting optimistic, and they stayed in touch, communicating as recently as May of this year. Then there was a Baiju's deck. The India-based EdTech service had been on a tear since 2016 when Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan invested $3.4 million in the company. By June 2021, Baiju's was valued at $16.5 million. Deschanel told People he was working directly with Anita Kishore, Baiju's 33-year-old chief strategy officer, on its next funding round. He was also getting, he said, help from his sister, Gabrielle de Rothschild Deschanel, an attorney at Citadel based in Chicago. In addition to an Akshat colleague who was leading the Baiju's push, his sister was copied on several emails relating to the deal. Baiju's, I mean, it is a proper deck, said Brian, the finance source, who was looking into working with him to raise funds. This is a real deck. I've seen decks before. This is a real deck. In September 2021, Akshat reportedly clinched a deal to lead the fundraising round for Baiju's Series F, which would bring in a total of $297 million. Regulatory filings with the Indian Ministry of Corporate Affairs showed that the investment was the equivalent of $160 million at the time. A leading Indian business outlet, Economic Times, mentioned Akshat several times in a 2021 article about the deal. That December, Reuters reported that Churchill Capital founder Michael Klein, a longtime advisor to the Saudi Public Investment Fund and Aramco, was exploring a deal with Baiju's to raise $4 billion to take the company public via an SPAC valuing it at $48 billion. Those who knew him said that Deschanel exhibited outward signs of stress around this time. Donna described watching him take many phone calls at the start of 2022 with backers, often in Arabic. He took trips to Washington, telling her he was meeting with ambassadors, she said. There were a few very large Middle Eastern investors that he introduced to Akshat, Stern said in his statement. He represented that these investors stemmed from his Saudi connections. Deschanel told People he looped in his sister at Citadel as legal counsel. He was working the phones nonstop. Brian, the source in finance, said that a number of investors turned him down, citing, vaguely, red flags. According to a New Delhi reporter for the Singapore-based financial blog, The Morning Context, the Baiju's board introduced a resolution in March 2022 stating that the LLC providing the funds wouldn't be Akshat, but a related entity called DRD Holdings. In emails, Deschanel would sign his full last name as de Rothschild Deschanel. In July 2022, the outlet reported that the DRD Holdings / Akshat funds never made it to Baiju's. The company told the Morning Context that Akshat had never been the lead on the investment round, but the allotted shares for the company were still outstanding. The same month, Indian Member of Parliament Karti P. Chidambaram said that he was referring an investigation into Baiju's finances to the government's fraud regulator, but Baiju's held firm and said that the funds would be delivered in August. Donna said Deschanel seemed to be in constant conversation with his sister. At one point, Donna asked why he couldn't just have his family, whom he had time and again represented as institutionally wealthy, help him out. She said Deschanel told her that his family didn't like to use its own money on such deals when it could find outside investors. Deschanel's social acquaintances at the time said that he continued to party throughout this period. According to Donna, he turned up to her workplace after being at an after-hours until dawn, residue in his nose. He would spend time at the new Dow Group-owned establishments at the recently opened Moxie Hotel on the Bowery, often hanging with Dylan Hales, who had been brought in to run the spaces. Little Ways was a particular favorite. In February, Hales co-hosted Deschanel's birthday party, where the guest of honor secured more than half the tables and invited hundreds to celebrate. According to the list on the invitation sheet, Leonardo DiCaprio RSVP'd no, saying, "Happy day, my guy, all love," with a blue heart emoji. A representative for DiCaprio did not reply to a request for comment. By early 2023, Bijoux announced that Oxshott had withdrawn from the funding round. Around this time, friends say Deschanel started to hit them up for cash, asking a person for $250,000 and promising a return within a week. He put seamless charges on a girlfriend's card until she caught him and walked out of the house. He used Teenie's credit card to pay for Ubers and ran up tabs. She confronted him. He denied it. But she said, "I knew it was him. You don't steal a credit card and go to Little Ways for a $500 brunch, which is his favorite place next to his house. And then I got the receipt, and it's his effing drink order," she said. The tab included 8 Aperol spritzers, oysters, steak and eggs, a burger, and 2 orders of Casamigos Blanco, with an extra charge to use the liquor to make an espresso martini. Tini clarified later that the tequila espresso martini was his SIG drink. He sent conspiracy-tinged text to friends about how he lost money or money got stolen from him. "So I'm an idiot. I keep all my credit cards and password on a convenient page in the Notes app, and then I made a questionable romantic choice for the evening last month. I have tens of thousands of dollars in charges," he texted Evans. "I hate myself." Next illustration shows our subject opening a bottle of champagne. Donna blocked all of Deschanel's numbers. She said she threatened to take out a restraining order after Deschanel continued to reach her via his Venmo account. His purported sister, Gabrielle de Rothschild Deschanel, emailed to attempt a mediation. Donna Googled the name and found nothing. Reached for comment, a representative at Citadel said it had no record of someone with her name or variations of it ever working here. "Is this Kyle?" she responded. "I know this has to be Kyle. He would offer to Venmo friends for meals and drinks and never follow through. The house that cost $25,000 a month to rent fell into disarray. His relationship with Vitolo started to stray as well. Rumors circulated about him hitting up fellow patrons for cash, or even trying to take out a large loan by playing up his connection to the restaurant. Apparently, according to multiple sources, Deschanel hosted a dinner with several female companions, ran up a bill, and then he ditched, stiffing his fellow diners. Eventually, Vitolo figured out that Deschanel wasn't in his high school class. There was another guy named Kyle. After I reached out in June, Vitolo said, I got better things to do with my life than talking about a fraud. In August, when presented with accounts of Deschanel attempting to use Emilio's Bellato to borrow funds, Vitolo texted all false, but declined to elaborate. And there were certain instances that pierced through the once impeccably maintained aura of wealth that Deschanel cultivated in himself. One nightlife friend faced such a moment when he asked Deschanel for a ride back to the city from Montauk after a weekend at the Surf Lodge. He was driving for a guy like him, supposedly with his lifestyle and whatnot. He was driving a very, very crappy car that was filled. When I tell you it was filled, dude, I'm talking about there would have been on the floor in the front seat 30 bottles of empty Diet Coke, the friend said. It was a junkyard. There was shit in the back seat. It was disgusting. And he told me that this was his assistant's car. He told me that his assistant was an Orthodox Hasidic. So throughout the car, there were various Hebrew books and all sorts of shit. For Teeny, such moments were small, at first. There was a $12,500 check that Deschanel asked her to cash for him. It was signed by someone named Saki Dodelson of Lakewood, New Jersey. Teeny and a friend we'll call Andrea discovered online that Dodelson was the founder of an education company called Beeble. LinkedIn revealed a woman in a white button-down shirt and blazer with droopy red earrings and eyeshadow. Deschanel said he was on the board of Beeble and shrugged it off. A few months later, Andrea was at 514 Broome Street, she said, drinking and smoking cigarettes, when she blurted out that she'd heard so much about Deschanel's family, but had never met any of them. Why weren't there any pictures on the walls? Deschanel tapped at his phone and showed her a picture of his mother. It was Saki Dodelson. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.